Hello, everyone, and welcome to WCET Frontiers Pod, where, along with passionate educational leaders, we explore practical solutions and innovations for technology-enhanced teaching and learning in higher education. I am your host, Dr. Elaine Villanueva Bernal, STEM Digital Learning Strategist for Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion for WCET, and a full-time lecturer at California State University, Long Beach. For today's episode, we are exploring STEM virtual labs with Evangeline, Evie Cummings, Assistant Provost, Assistant Provost and Director of UF Online for University of Florida. Welcome and happy Friday. Thank you so much for being here.
For having me, Elaine. I'm happy to be here. Happy Friday.
Yeah, happy Friday. Let's get right into it. Can you tell me about your work with UF and how you got into the world of online teaching and learning and currently with UF Online?
I'd be delighted to. So yeah, hi everybody. So I'm Evie Cummings, and I guess I'm a more non-traditional administrator. So I got into the realm of online education as an assistant provost. So I had a long and storied career in Washington, D.C., working on very related issues, which for me were at the Environmental Protection Agency, focused on what is the role of information as a strategic resource at a large public sector agency? What does public access mean in terms of the role of citizens and the role of their government? What sort of data of what sort of quality is appropriate to share and debate and discuss? So I've always been fascinated by this notion of public access, and in particular, the role of public institutions, and in this case, fantastic universities, in facilitating access, in serving the greater good. So that brought me to the University of Florida in 2015 to take on this new role of this incredibly controversial and interesting new program that was UF Online. This was the state of Florida saying thou shalt have a fully online undergraduate pathway to the flagship institution, and hurry up and grow it and work with Pearson and make magic happen. So I said, yeah, I'll jump in with both feet, come back to my hometown or my home state, and here I am.
Awesome. Thank you for sharing that. Sure. And I'm curious, you know, especially, you know, since we're still in the pandemic and online learning and teaching especially still has a very important place, you know, in education. So from your experience, how did online teaching pre-pandemic, at the beginning of the pandemic, and now still in the pandemic, evolve to meet students and faculty's needs?
I actually, you know, was a undergraduate in the 1990s who really enjoyed the flexibility of, at that time, video replay. And I think, you know, we tend to think about online as either a newish thing or a new thing. It certainly is something that, especially in light of the pandemic, is becoming more front and center in how we think about education, how we think about commerce, how we think about communication and celebration. It's front and center. But I think it really began decades and decades ago with the advent, actually probably over 100 years ago, with the notion of distance ed, correspondence ed, and all of these concepts of, so how do you either bring education to someone or facilitate the engagement of non-traditional students through alternative modalities, whether it's the post, whether it's video replay, whether it's online and digital education. So to me, it's gotten so much better. So it's a really exciting time to think about, now that we even have a greater sense of urgency and necessity for alternative ways to engage in light of the pandemic, how fortunate are we that we have so many institutions, mine included, but so many before us, that have really been deploying remarkable online courses, labs, learning environments, and what does that mean for access? And in particular, what does that mean for diversity, equity, and inclusion? And where we go next, I think, is actually quite exciting.
Awesome, thank you for that. And then you mentioned non-traditional students. Like, can you tell me more about the demographic of non-traditional students that you're serving through UF Online?
Yeah, and I'll say one of the joys of being a non-traditional administrator is kind of coming to higher ed and hearing these terms like non-traditional and understanding that there's a belief in what non-traditional is and isn't, and then there's facts. So let's focus on facts, Elaine. So when we talk about the non-traditional student, I think most people probably listening would agree that the non-traditional has become traditional. Mm-hmm. So here, at least at the University of Florida, even the typical undergrad has a job. Mm-hmm. And then nationally, what, 25% of undergrads have kids. So in a way, that population is more acutely seen in the online modality, but those very same students leading fascinating multidimensional lives are walking around this campus as well as residential students. I will say, when we launched UF Online, it was to reach students who wanted to come to a great school and earn the same degree. They didn't want to live in the dorm, mm-hmm. and they didn't want to attend all their classes face-to-face. So that for us is the non-traditional, someone that's looking for greater agility, greater flexibility, and more freedom of movement. So that's who we serve in UF Online, are the folks that really want to leverage freedom of movement, freedom of time, and lead multidimensional lives. We have students across the state of Florida, across 43 states and 16 countries, from ages 12 to 72. It's a fascinating 25% of our students are raising dependents under the age of 18. Another 20% tell us they're raising, they're caring for adults and elderly relatives. About 7% of our students are doing both. So mm-hmm. the sandwich generation. We have military affiliated students. We're so proud to support active duty. 60% of our students are working full time. Like, they're not just working, they're working more than 30 hours a week. So again, this to me is the exciting time we're in, which is people are leading busy lives. They're getting to make choices about how they integrate all those things into their lives and how that changes every month and every year. And how can a university be a part of that? I think the modern university has to realize it's not the only thing going on. You know, our students have a lot of things they want to do, a lot of things they want to accomplish. We are not going to be, you know, it's not like our students are in a movie and we're the only thing on the screen, right? There are so many other people want to have quality of life. They want to travel. They want to even, you know, start a family. And so how do universities adapt to not being the center of attention? I think that's the challenge going forward.
Yeah. And I like that you said that, because I think, at least from my experience and, you know, online, you know, virtual, you know, learning and teaching settings, mm-hmm. it's about, you know, is it about like content delivery, right? But it's really giving people options and that freedom of choice, right? To personalize right. their education the way they want to, because there's just life to be led, you know?
And faculty too. I mean, yeah. Let's talk about faculty.
Yeah, let's talk about faculty.
Yeah, let's go there. But I mean, just the fact that my husband's a professor, like, you know, he can be traveling to Paris, meeting with colleagues at Doctors Without Borders, talking about a study that they're doing in Senegal, and he can be delivering a lecture for his epidemics class that he teaches here at UF. And so how cool is that for our students to be able to meet faculty in this digital classroom? Mm-hmm. They're out there doing amazing things, let alone the fact that faculty are also caregivers. They also have other responsibilities, and to be able to dynamically deliver learning and to, one of the things I think that's super exciting for our faculty is to be able to convene these fascinating classrooms full of students that are also very diverse in age and background. Mm-hmm. You know, through UF Online, we're beaming in amazing students that are full-time law enforcement officers, just one example. And, you know, we also have residential students that are all in, let's say, you know, criminology courses together. What is possible thanks to this agility and flexibility should actually lead to greater, more diverse exchange, debate, and yet also better quality of life. Like, we want to have it all, right?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sensing too is that there is more opportunity to create community among people who would probably have never met if it was just like our traditional, you know, modality for online, or I mean for learning. Yeah.
Well, this is also the promise of the flipped classroom that we've heard for a while, which I think is a real promise, which is to say, wow, okay, we could actually have some things done in advance. You mm-hmm. can watch the lecture in advance. And then it creates a new opportunity for community, for collaboration, or again, debate. Once everyone's read the text or done the experiment, and let's come together and say, okay, we've read Locke's thinking, we've read Immanuel Kant's, like now let's come in and let's have a good debate about what that means. And so our challenge is, and it's another great challenge. So how do you convene those, even those synchronous moments with really busy folks?
Yeah.
And for us, we found great success if you just plan. You plan, you notify people when it's going to be, and you give them every opportunity to participate in the way that makes sense for them. It's that intentional design. So I think that's really where we're going to be headed going forward.
I appreciate that. Thank you so much. You said intentional design, and then you mentioned your spouse is teaching epidemiology. So let's talk about STEM. And a major part of your work is getting folks excited about, STEM labs, right? Virtual labs, mm-hmm. teaching STEM online. What have you seen as far as like changes, challenges, and success in teaching STEM courses online, especially virtual labs?
Yeah, I think one of the most promising opportunities afforded us by online formats, hybrid formats, is rethinking who has access to STEM careers, who can get involved in science and math and computer science. It's no longer going to be the domain of the full-time 19-year-old student who could afford to have college as their only thing. So that to me is very exciting, step one, which is through different modalities, through greater flexibility, through more universal design of our learning spaces to welcome all learners. Think about now who's going to be in the classroom. So that's really cool. And then the next challenge, which again, I don't want to overuse the word exciting, but I do think it's a great opportunity for the Academy to say, okay, so how do we leverage all of these tools to really engaging STEM learning spaces? What's possible now in these spaces? And so we've taken a lot of attention paid a lot of attention to that here at the University of Florida as we look at STEM lab environments. Mm-hmm. So I will say with love, looking back upon my own undergraduate experience, there was the lecture and then you had that lab and you had a certain number of hours a week and you were trying to take multiple courses at the same time. You were also trying to do your experiments, take your notes, reflect, all that kind of stuff. And so now we're trying to think about, all right, so how do you deliver that for an online student? And so we've been running here across the Florida State University system, a STEM lab task force, which has been looking specifically at that, which is, okay, for the busy learner, the learner who doesn't want to live in the dorm, how do they get the great STEM lab experience too? And we've been trying to think about, okay, does that mean all the labs go online? Not necessarily. So mm-hmm. how do you give faculty chemistry faculty like yourself, the autonomy and the space to be creative? I mean, think about the last time, Elaine, you had like time to really get creative on how you wanted to design your labs. Hopefully you have that time a lot, but it isn't always something we think about for our lab instruction. It's more like, this is the lab, these are the learning outcomes, it's a building block and a curriculum, and this is how we've done it, and go.
It's always been sort of like these canned, series of labs, right? And I'm thinking about my own undergraduate experience, like, here's a lab, here's a lecture, now do the thing. You're like, okay.
Right. And you have to do this, and these are the labs, these are the 10 labs, this is what we do. And so we've tried to figure out, how do you give instructors the space and the autonomy, and how do you empower them to get creative, which is to say, okay, if my students will never step foot on campus, mm-hmm. how am I going to do that anatomy lab? And what emerges, thanks to talented instructors, are a variety of experiments in home, outside the home, on campus, but instead of an hour a week, 2 weeks over the summer. It's really I mean, the success we've had at the University of Florida is really due to the individuals, the experts in the different disciplines that thought, okay, I'm going to do an entomology lab and I'm going to have kids, students send me
collection.
You know, you can think about like, you know, huh, well, since the students aren't going to be on campus, we have to ship them something for their physics lab, but mm-hmm. how do we still hold them to the same standards as our campus students? And wow, the labs we were doing on campus, given our time constraints, given the physical spaces of our labs, given mm-hmm. the number of students, we're already kind of very limited in what, like the basic biology lab here is pretty basic in terms of what everyone has to do.
Yeah,
so wow,
yeah.
What can we do in an online environment? And one of our faculty here at the University of Florida said, you know, let's do a fully virtual evolutionary biology upper division lab. And they can actually dissect axolotls, which are now one of the most favorite creatures ever.
Same.
They're adorable.
Same.
So they're so cool. So, but you know, in the virtual space, the students have to anesthetize the axolotls.
Anesthetize. Yeah, I think so.
Thank you. And I mean, there's all kinds of cool stuff. So I think back to, as an undergrad, to what extent were the labs seen as the gateway I had to pass through? Mm. And oh my God, I hope I had a good lab partner and, you know, and had to finish that. And I was thinking about grad school, I was thinking about med school, versus what if there are these really creative, engaging learning spaces where, yeah, you also have to still complete them.
Yes.
But what if we could unlock new ways of engaging with one another, with the content, with the instructor? And so, but I think a lot of this, like I guess I'm implying, is that how are we making this space for our faculty? To create, to invent, to try different formats, especially when they're exhausted.
Yeah.
So that's our challenge too.
Yeah, and I was just reading an article, I think from one of the UK media outlets. Yeah, that we're just kind of beyond exhausted right now. You know,
right.
So how do you meet those needs of? I mean, you don't know if you have to like turn on a, you know, dime, right? And just be fully online again, or, you know, what, like how you can serve your students, right? So yeah, I can totally understand that, you know, faculty are tired. And then I think when you provide an opportunity like this to be creative and to really kind of like take control of your class, it's sort of like, it's refreshing, honestly. It's very refreshing.
I mean, this was something in the federal space, excuse me, we used to always try to find the upshot of a major budget crisis. So whenever mm-hmm. we knew Congress was meeting and our budget was going to get slashed, it at least forced you to think about, so what's actually really important here? If we had to cut, if we had to, you know, what really matters here? And it would cause a reassortment, excuse me, of priorities, of energy and of time. And it was emotionally exhausting.
Mm-hmm.
But I can look back on it somewhat fondly because at least you went through this, okay, what are we really here to do? So I think higher ed is in that same moment, which is, okay, everyone's exhausted. There's limited time and energy. What are we really here to do? And if we only have so many hours in a week, which I hope we're getting back to the notion that 40 hours max a week is a humane thing, like you know, bringing our work hours back into a fenced in area and not an unlimited area. Given that, what are we really here to do? And how are we going to do it? And that also means universities reflecting on, okay, what are all the things we're expecting faculty to do?
Mm-hmm.
And how does that align with what the priorities are for the institution? So for us as a land grant R1, you know, AAU school, we have a really strong and important research mission. A big part of who we are is knowledge generation.
Yeah.
Another one is teaching and, you know, really helping the next scientists, learners, artists emerge and create their knowledge as well. And we also have a service to our community. So an engagement in our community. So, okay, those are our three things. How are we going to do those things really efficiently, really well, and still have joy at the end of the week?
Or maybe midweek, you know, it depends, right?
Maybe after day one. Oh, we have to wait till the weekend. But how, and then I think that is going to cause us to go, huh, well, okay, so if we're expecting faculty to be tremendous research leaders, mm-hmm. with grants, citations, publications, a lot, and we're expecting them to be amazing teachers, oh, and now you want them to get creative about their courses and labs, Like something has to give.
Yeah.
I think you've seen it nationally, some different cadres emerging of the research faculty, the practitioner faculty, the teaching faculty. I'd also love to see more teaching teams, meaning subject matter experts informing, well, this is what the lab, you know, this is what really matters for the physics lab. These are really the learning objectives and skills they need to get out of physics one versus two. And then you can have teams that go and execute that still under the tutelage and wisdom of the subject matter expert.
Yeah.
But you can deploy instructional designers, design teams, graduate assistants, teaching assistants, an apprenticeship model for faculty that also really want to give back in the teaching space as they ascend. But through these teams and through these investments in not only instructional designers, but other key parts of the, you know, the modern workforce across our universities, which include academic advisors. So recognizing, I think, the what we want to do, why we're here, what we really care about, and the fact that we want it to continually get better and get creative and get exciting and get more agile. So we're going to have to shift how we staff, support, and look at like the human infrastructure of our universities. Right? I don't think you're just going to ask an already exhausted faculty cadre who for some campuses have been like online, on campus, masks, no masks, like academic freedom, no academic freedom.
I know, high flex, all virtual, right?
You know, depending on the headline, it's a little, there's a lot of whiplash, a lot of exhaustion. Yeah. And I think a feeling of like, do people really know what it takes to thrive? And am I being given the autonomy? Am I being supported in whatever I'm trying to contribute to this university? And I think that I long for that recalibration.
Yeah.
And I think it's coming in 2022.
Yeah. So given just the context that you described, you know, with faculty and students, right? And like that human infrastructure and, you know, like ideally people will teach in teams and, you know, just what you talked about. Can you talk about how various STEM disciplines have developed their courses to these online platforms?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so here at the University of Florida, we have the benefit of a fantastic microbiology and cell science program, physics, math, computer science, chemistry. And I think what we've seen emerge is really fundamentally based on the unique, I call them micro environments, because of course I do, like in the department, it's really its own unique culture, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Comprised of amazing individuals and what they decide to do. So what we've seen coming out of microbiology and cell science actually for quite some time before I even got here, was a rethinking of how they did their labs for undergraduates, which involved what they call a boot camp model. So they would say, okay, we have these busy adult learners. They want flexibility, they want agility. Mm-hmm. They still want quality, they still want time with the faculty. They're just not in town. Some of them are actually outside the country.
Yeah.
How are we gonna give them the amazing, in-person University of Florida lab experience, but on their own terms? And so they reinvented their labs and turned them into a summer experience. And I initially heard about this and was like, yeah, but is that, aren't you asking too much of these learners? Are they really going to come to town? Do they have time to just, since they're working and caring for kids, can they just take 2 weeks off? And the answer was yes, if you plan. It's mind-boggling, right? If
yeah.
You planning. Them, you give them a year or two notice, meaning part of your program will involve a face-to-face summer lab component. They will not only plan for it, they will pick this program because of that experience.
Awesome.
So we've actually seen students that, you know, one of the best parts of their whole time is when they come to campus for the summer lab experience. We've also seen different things. Our anatomy labs involve shipping these custom designed kits of, yes, fetal pigs and more. The faculty have designed the curriculum around these kits. Similar with physics, the physics department. Didn't like any of, this is the other thing with STEM labs. A lot of there's a lot of companies out there that say, oh, we got you. We'll send kits. It's great. And mm-hmm. Our faculty have looked at some of those kits and said, well, so I wouldn't have included that. I would have included this. So a lot, we work with our faculty to basically custom design, taking off the shelf what we can, but then adapting what's already out there to accomplish what the faculty want. So the physics department, for example, said, oh, there's this really great tool students can buy on Amazon, this iOS lab, but we want to custom design the curriculum, the labs, the activities. And so that's where we are with physics. So what's really interesting to me is there's no one size fits all. It depends on the faculty, the department. Now, a big thing we say centrally here for UF Online is I say, you know, I want you to be creative. I want you to experiment. And I never want you to worry about the cost of this on the student as you're getting creative. So we, the Central UF Online Innovation Fund, will defray costs so that the students don't bear the cost, especially in the initial semester. Because sometimes when you're doing something for the first time, the kit can actually be quite expensive.
Yeah.
Especially if it's custom. So we want to help support those, as our in-house team does, to centrally fund some of these kits, especially when they're in the beginning. Maybe over time we can bring the cost down through efficiency and other ways of producing the kits. But anyway, that's another way we try to encourage that innovation, which will vary by STEM discipline. The other thing we've done to help these programs when they build these amazing STEM, not only labs, but STEM courses, so take our computer science program, we're also investing in the human infrastructure, which is a undergraduate coordinator that works in that department. And our academic strategies team will help them build digital libraries to be housed in the department that hold all of the digital assets created by the department, the courses, the labs, and then it can be a go-to resource for that department. Otherwise, what we found was that some departments have done amazing things, and then in the hustle for the next semester, Joe finds out, oh, I'm teaching data structures in the spring? Okay, wait, was there a Canvas shell? And somehow Joe doesn't even know that there's already a Canvas course developed. And it was like, oh my gosh, not only does that stress out Joe, like I got 2 weeks to get ready for data structures, but it's such a whole set of wasted energy for the faculty before him and instructional designers that built this incredible Canvas shell for that course. So anyway, that's another thing that we're doing to help not only support faculty and foster teams, but also help the faculty leverage these libraries that they're creating of their own content. So if things change hands, they at least have a go-to place for the department to know what they can draw upon for their course, if that makes sense.
Oh, that, yeah, totally makes sense. And what I'm hearing is that there's a lot of, there seems to be a lot of autonomy, creativity among the departments as far as like what their capacities are, what they can do, what they want to do, right? So that they feel empowered to teach the way they want to teach. So now I'm curious, to what extent are departments doing things in-house, or do folks work with publishers? Can you talk a little bit more about that as far as like resources?
Yeah, so I think our overwhelming tendency is in-house, generally speaking. However, especially when the pandemic hit, we invested centrally in two major kind of enterprise-wide sets of assets from the private sector. So we invested in a Labster subscription, which is a treasure trove of virtual environments and labs and online labs and different imagery that faculty could look at and potentially plug into their lab. And also Jove was another subscription that we purchased enterprise-wide, unlimited for on an annual basis. We renew it, which is a journal of visual information, so that virtual information, so that ways different STEM disciplines from mechanical engineering, entomology to biology can also pull and plug in video, peer-reviewed videos and experiments and plug those into their labs. I think by and large, our STEM labs and courses are still completely in-house built. But we encourage them as they build them to leverage digital assets, video, off-the-shelf kits that maybe they want to customize. And you might be wondering, so how do faculty figure this all out? So we also
this is a lot of stuff.
Hey, like, tell me more. So we have a Center for Online Innovation and Production. And if you are going to be offering an online course or an online lab or anything to online students via UF Online, we ask that all go through our Center for Online Innovation and Production, that can also just pair you with an instructional designer and talk you through. Maybe you've never heard of Joe. Maybe you have no idea what Labster is. They'll help talk through based on what you want to accomplish in your course. What are some of the tools that you can leverage? And maybe you also want to try something right now. Maybe next year you'll come back and think about trying something else. So that's another point I guess I wanted to make, is that it's a team effort, but it's also, these have a temporal domain, right? You don't just teach physics and then you're done.
Yeah.
That lab, that course evolves over time. It might change hands. It might have the benefit of a new graduate assistant that's like, you know, we don't have an experiment in this, we should try it. And so these are evolving spaces. And how do you help them evolve, even as they might change hands, as the department chairs change? Part of it's the library concept, at least giving you the anchor of the content you have to date. But it's investing in teams like the Center for Online Innovation and Production, and ensuring that all of our folks know that these are very in-house human relationships. So
yeah,
when Joe teaches data structures, and let's say he teaches it again in a year, he can reach back out to the instructional designer that worked with him to say, you know, in the fourth lab or in the fourth assignment, everyone seems getting tripped up on what I'm asking. Can we tweak that and bring in maybe some additional content? And the instructional designer be like, yeah, let me get you on my schedule and let's go back and just do that one thing. So we want to keep that relationship going so that these courses and labs can evolve as the faculty want them to.
Yeah, and I like what you said about that, because I think, you know, especially at the beginning of the pandemic, there seemed to be a notion of like, oh, turning your class into an online environment was seemed to be a very solitary thing.
Right.
But it actually takes a team. It takes literally a community to, hey, let's just take this one thing and let's work together on this one thing. And it doesn't have to, you don't have to do all the things, you know,
right.
And you can work together to iteratively improve your class.
Well, and I mean, just to go back and pick on my husband again, like, he's a busy epidemiologist. I don't expect him to know what PlayPosit is or VoiceThread or like, oh, have you thought about, do you know there's this thing called Jove? And so, but he's an expert in his field, but we have folks that are experts in like modern teaching practices and tools.
Yeah.
And together, magic can happen. So, you know, how are we helping faculty, as you're saying, not have it be a solitary exercise? They're still in a position of power and authority, and they have to really bring to that, like, what should the students come away with from this course? What are the learning objectives? How does that relate to the curriculum? But the how of that, and the even adapting, like, you know, we, unfortunately, the pandemic is sadly one of many emerging disruptive events. So we often have students that are now, like, they're in a local area where there are some evacuations due to wildfires, or especially here, tremendous storm events and people are losing power. And so faculty have to pivot already.
Yeah.
To say, okay, you know, I actually have a lot of students here in the panhandle of Florida. I have a lot of National Guard students. They got pulled up for storm response. How am I going to do that assignment for them? I'll not only give them more time, but maybe what I'll ask them to do is tape a video. You know what I mean? Like, there's already a sense of agility is required. And so who's helping that faculty member think that through before the course, but also in that moment? And I see that's the team ethos, and that's the role of the instructional designer. And on a related note, that also is on us as a program. So what we try to do is we immediately can send out, we can tell where students are located based on where they tell us where they are through our registrar. And we can say, hey, heads up, Elaine, just so you know, I don't know if you know, but these two folks in your class, they live near that emergency happened last week. So just a heads up, you're a busy faculty member.
Yeah.
But we're all in this together. So just a heads up, we've already reached out to them. We're connecting them with their academic advisor and university resources for emergency grants. But in case you're wondering what's up with them, please check in with them, but just so you know, we're also checking in with them too. So that way that's also not all on faculty to have to figure out.
Yeah. And I think what's important about what you said is that, you know, as you know, climate change is raging. I'll just say that it keeps in mind that, you know, just in our nation, there are several climate emergencies that happen, and it certainly keeps that in mind, you know, and still, like, we want to help students succeed. So thank you for sharing that.
Well, and, you know, so if you're a university president right now, your head might be exploding, right? Which is like, oh my God, I got to think about online, and I got to think about different ages and caregiver, and now they're in different places. It's like, yeah. And that's actually quite thrilling. So if you really think about the modern university and its learning community, it's potentially a global dynamic enterprise. But then what are the implications for student life and academic integrity? Like, these are the fascinating challenges going forward, where we're going to need the brightest minds eager to try to figure it all out.
Yep, exactly. So now let's talk about students, because one of the things that you mentioned, like, what are students walking away, you know, from, you know, with as far as online learning. So tell me about student achievement and engagement in these online spaces.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think generally speaking, you know, we're happy to shift a conversation away from, you know, higher ed's traditional focus on a full-time 4 to 5 to 6 year graduation rate. Mm-hmm. A certain, I will say residentially, probably a different grade distribution than you will see in adult learners. You know, a lot of times we'll talk about, like, oh, the adult learners are doing okay, but, you know, the average is a B or a C plus. It's like, well, they're passing the class.
And that's
as a adult learner myself in graduate school, you know, if I got a paper in and I actually did really well and I was proud of it and it met the expectations, I didn't need the A. But that's because I was at a different life stage. It's not necessarily a reflection of that I'm not as, you know, I'm not progressing as much as my, you know, 19-year-old peer in the same course, if that makes sense.
That makes sense.
I think there's that initial recalibration of what is success, what are the role of high stakes tests, and, you know, what's up with that? That's a whole other podcast. But we are seeing, you know, great success and persistence in the online learning space. So we are seeing here at the University of Florida, our new students this year persisting at a rate of 89% during a pandemic.
Yeah.
So we feel like we're going to, and that's where our focus is going to continue to be, which is on, okay, how are we as a traditional R1 repositioning our supports, but also our own understanding of what our students need and what persistence looks like in the modern era? Mm-hmm. And then how are we encouraging more students to pursue a path through an online modality, knowing that they'll get that support? And then on the other end, we're proud to see our graduates going on and being incredibly successful, getting into medical school, veterinary school, law school. So that's the next thing that really has to happen. As you kind of invent these amazing spaces and the faculty do incredible things, you don't want your students to hit a brick wall applying to med school. And someone's like, oh, but the physics lab was online. It's like, okay. So that's the next frontier that I personally really want to focus on in 2022, mm-hmm. which is, and going beyond, what are the professional schools thinking and evaluating when they look at these transformative undergraduate STEM courses and labs, and how are our students going to be best served when they hit those more traditional stages and admissions procedure. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And then, so with that, I mean, how do you address that? Like, you know, we're preparing students and, you know, of course, for me teaching chemistry, like, I have so many students who want to go to med school, right? So how do you address the concern that these virtual labs or online spaces, especially in STEM, may not be preparing students for graduate or professional settings? How do you address that currently?
I think there's one part of it which is completely legitimate and appropriate, which is, are you achieving the same learning objectives online as you are in mm-hmm. this physical lab space? And that's the challenge for us and for faculty and instructors and lab leads to figure out, how do you do that in this? And there can be bad online labs. Mm-hmm. So how do you not do that? So that's the first thing. Like, how do you make it good?
How do you not make it? Yeah.
How do you not make it bad? Then the second is, there is just fundamental, straight up, let's say it out loud, explicit bias against online learning in our medical school admissions. And I've heard it, I've seen it, I've had it talked to me firsthand, which is, well, we really just kind of know the students that come from certain programs. And if we haven't seen students come from your program before, we don't really know how they're going to do, which is an inherently like biased way to look at anything.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not going to eat that restaurant unless my best friend, unless I know someone that ate there, then I'm not even going to give it a shot, you know? So part of that then is a job for us as a program. We need to be really effective at targeting communications. We need to be out there talking about what we're doing, why we think it's effective, promoting what our faculty are doing to reach the hearts and minds of the admissions, the very human admissions folks at these top med schools. So I've actually, in my spare time, Elaine, been looking at, you know, Hopkins, Yale, and others, their med schools, and how during the pandemic, they were like, oh yeah, well, we'll allow for some online courses when you apply to Hopkins Medical School because everybody went online in 2020.
Yeah.
And seeing now, okay, so what happens now?
What happens now?
Like, are you snapping back to everyone has to have done these things face-to-face? You know, what's next is a fascinating conversation for, as you think about STEM careers.
Yeah.
You know, as I'm like, okay, who are going to be the future doctors, virologists, epidemiologists, nurses, engineers, astronauts? That's not just a bachelor's. So how are we helping adult learners, students of all backgrounds, student parents? How are we helping them access those careers? And what does that mean then for professional school after that, for medical school, vet school? And I think that's another thing to watch. I think a lot of folks are looking at what happens to undergrad in fall 22. And I'm like, well, I want to know what happened to med school in fall 22. Like, what happened to med school applications for 23? And how are these, how are these American Medical Association and these major enterprises looking at STEM education in the undergraduate realm? And are they going to still continue to lump all online together? Like, oh, well, like, I think Hopkins previously pre-pandemic was like, oh, we don't accept any online courses.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, well, it's because you're worried about the University of Phoenix or you're worried about the University of Florida? Because we like to think there's a difference. So, but we need to do a better job as University of Florida in showing what we're doing, because they might know about our traditional, they might know our students from our traditional residential program, but just wait till they meet our graduates of our online program. And there'll be these incredible, like, think about it, like a someone who's decided to pursue med school at the age of 35 after a military career. Why can't they go to med school? Why can't, even if they finish their degree, their STEM degree online, if they had what it took to do that at UF, they're gonna be the best student you could have at your med school. But how are they considered versus automatically eliminated because they pursued their undergraduate online?
Yeah, so I'm hearing that, you know, as far as working with graduate and professional programs, there needs to be more of a shift in thinking about how is it that online programs are, you know, benefiting, you know, especially the non-traditional student, right, quote unquote. And and then also being able to tell that story of like, hey, here's how our students in, you know, online spaces have succeeded and are prepared for these graduate and professional programs.
And there's another side of it too, which is I want to know, and I'm sure our faculty do as well, what are the things that the med schools are really concerned about?
Yeah.
You know, and we want to fix that. So if they're like, well, we love that you have the online program, but, you know, we feel like, and I've heard it described to me as well, we're worried about their communication. Like, are they just home? I've literally been told, are they just home in their pajamas?
Wow.
Doing their courses. And I'm like, hey, being home in your pajamas is pretty awesome.
Okay. Yeah. Let's put this
at a bad future doctor makes me comfortable. Thank you. But anyway, I think, you know, there is this, so that's where the bias comes out again. I, a med school admissions person, will feel better if I knew that your students were all in a lecture hall hearing a chemistry lecture. Because I think that leads to more communication skills. So kind of teasing that out, I think, is okay, what are you, and then, because I also want to make sure that we're doing the best thing for our students. So how are we ensuring that our courses are up to snuff? So that way, you know, when medical schools make the shift, you know, what are their concerns about quality? And then how do we make sure we're addressing them? So it's on us too, is my point.
Got it. Yeah. And then, so that brings us have one more question, I promise. The future of virtual labs, even just looking at 2022. I mean, so far what I'm hearing is that there needs to be more of a communication happening, especially among undergrad, graduate, professional programs, as well as within the institution. There needs to be communication, teamwork around faculty, students, you know, administration, staff, right? Tell me more about what you think is the future, you know, future of STEM online learning spaces and virtual labs.
So, I mean, I think as we look to fall 22, fall 23, we're going to see, you know, we know about the demographic cliff shift coming. So mm-hmm. we should already portend that our students are going to be much more variable in terms of age and life stage. We also know that even the youngsters who prefer a residential program are coming in with heightened expectations that they too will be able to leverage online formats for all the flexibility. They expect, oh, well, my lecture is going to be available, right? The lecture is going to be recorded, right? So given that those different forces are happening, how does that manifest in our exhausted campus and workforce? Mm-hmm. and just like do a very simple reflection on yourself and say, well, how would I want to tackle that? And it's probably going to be with space to be creative, support, and a sense of relative priority, and a recognition of the fact that faculty, depending on the institution, are also expected to do X, Y, Z, right? Depending on where you work, you might have different expectations. So I think a recalibration of the expectations with the stark reality of what the students want and need are the future going forward. So I think that's going to mean, ultimately though, and this is where I say, you know, there are some bedrock components of higher ed that are working. So let's just mm-hmm. go with it, which includes faculty driving the content of their courses. Now, there you might say, well, some faculty just have taught the same lecture for 30 years. So that's not okay. So we can have ways to make sure that that's not happening. But I still believe really strongly in the fact that the beauty of the University of Florida should be that you have the top research faculty that also infuse the classroom. So I'm going to keep my focus there, but I'm going to surround those faculty with what they need to be successful. And that includes a whole bunch of other folks, staff experts on our campuses, which are going to help faculty deliver the next generation. And then also working more efficiently, like you build it once, that might actually work for a while. You don't have to keep reinventing it every semester.
Yeah.
helping you know who's in your classroom, helping your students get access to resources they need. You know, there are a whole bunch of other efficiencies that can be gained as well.
Awesome. So Evie, thank you so much for spending time with me today and sharing with our audience our continued and growing value, especially, you know, these STEM virtual labs, online spaces, right? And I think the biggest thing that I got from, you know, talking to you today is that there's this like humanizing and meaningful and real process and actually making these online spaces, you're not just going online. Yeah.
Right. The people that are building them. And I think the human workforce angle for higher ed, I don't know if we've just thought that everyone now is a robot and they're going to snap back after COVID and
exactly
back to the heyday. I don't know when that was. You know, but how are we recognizing that there's a very human element? And AI, by the way, is not going to solve everything.
Yeah.
Only human beings. And how do we move forward? I think it's an exciting time. So I appreciate you having me on.
Awesome. And then for the folks listening in, thank you so much. And please follow us at the WCET Frontiers Pod. Thanks, folks. And we'll see you next time or hear from you next time.